One of the reasons that I wanted to lay that foundation of human sexuality is that I think we can draw on that in dealing with the issue of homosexuality, because many of the kind of assumptions that are made about a heterosexual behavior, the same assumptions are being made about a homosexual behavior. And so I think that helps us in some ways. I have to take guesses because I don't know enough, and I haven't been able to ask enough of you about it. In the United States, and I'm assuming this is true where you are, the issue of the rights of homosexual people, persons, and couples have moved forward so rapidly that it has now become almost a government legal type issue if you do not deal with that topic very carefully where you are. And while statistics in the United States tell us that about 2% at best of the world's population is homosexually oriented, about 90% of our television programs in America now have a homosexual character in them. We're in a context where there is this push to normalize this, and the government has participated in this, law has participated in this, entertainment has participated in it, and you suddenly, if you have anything negative to say about homosexuality, you are placed in a category and somewhat branded, and you're out of the conversation. Is that true where you live? And then at the same time, you have the older populations within our church that have just decided this is wrong. That's the end of it. No discussion needed. So you have a younger generation who wants to have the conversation, an older generation that would really rather not even talk about this. So this is a very challenging kind of issue for us in our pastoral relationships. If you'll permit, here's the way we'll do this. I want to read to you just a little bit, and then there are six or seven questions that I think are the kind of questions that we are being asked these days, and I want to pose those questions and then say this is how I think a pastor might respond to these particular questions. I'll read about a half a page here. Once upon a time, homosexuality was little more than a joke, a rare mention, or a suspicion. Today, it is day-to-day reality. The issue is before us. It is out of the closet. We have friends and relatives, co-workers and church leaders who in one way or another are dealing with homosexuality. It's in the newspaper, it's on television, it is in our schools. The issue divides people and churches. It is tearing apart friendships, congregations, and homes. We're watching even denominations divide over this very issue in the United States. Our initial reaction to homosexuality may be one of anger or denial or repulsion. At one time, homosexuality was dismissed as immoral by the dominant majority. It was simply wrong. And some went further with name-calling, and words like fag and queer and dyke and queen and fairy, we attach these to our fellow human beings with the same kind of recklessness that glutton, drunkard, and friend of sinners was attached to Jesus. And homosexuals found themselves as the butt of our jokes or our cliches. This kind of response is neither helpful nor Christian. As a pastor, I've sat face to face with those who struggle with their sexual orientation. Some of them were broken and empty. Others were angry and militant. So I want to offer some of the kind of questions that have been asked and talk about how pastors might respond to this. Here's the first question. What is the moral status of a person who discovers that they are homosexually oriented? What is the moral status of this person? This is where I think we have to distinguish between sexual orientation and sexual behavior. Okay, sexual orientation and sexual behavior. I would say 98-99% of those who are homosexually oriented did not wake up one morning and choose to be homosexually oriented. I know matter of fact, I don't know any people who say, I chose this orientation. They discovered it about themselves. Now, there are, I've read all the studies, and I'm really still open to learn from science and sociology, and medical technology. I'm willing to learn about the causes of homosexuality. Born that way, my friends who are genetic biologists tell me that's not possible because the homosexuality gene is not a gene that leads to reproducing. And genes always move in the direction of reproduction. So they're saying it's not genetic. But at the same time, they say it could be biological. It could be that in fetal development, there is a chemical bath of the brain that what literally happens is that it short circuits some of the neurons from right brain to left brain, and it affects someone so that they lean toward the characteristics of male or female in one way. It is a chemical bath that happens, and for men, it happens in a particular way, and for women, it happens in another way. If people tell you that men are half-brained, that's true. That really is true. There is a biological function that happens, and we're not able to do some of the things mentally that women are. So I do think there's a possibility that in fetal development, I think that's one of the possibilities. Another is that the kind of family that one grows up in, there are certain dynamics within that family that can move the sexual orientation of a child in one way or the other. We do know that child abuse can affect one's sexual orientation in very distinct and direct ways. Or early sexual experimentation as a child, 9, 10, 11, 12 in there. I mean, so there are several different reasons. I actually don't believe any one of those is the answer for all of those. I believe there are a variety of reasons why a person's sexual orientation becomes what it is. But whatever it is, in almost all of those cases, no one is making a moral choice to be this way. And when we define sin as the moral choice of a person, we have to recognize that God does not hold one morally accountable for what is not a moral choice. So the person who discovers that they are homosexually oriented should not be placed in an immoral category because they discovered that about themselves. But we all act on our orientation, and this is where choice enters the issue. This is where we do make choices, and these are moral choices, choices about how we behave. And in the same way that the person who discovers that they are heterosexually oriented, that heterosexual orientation is neither moral or immoral, it's just what they know about themselves. But they will make moral choices about how they act on that orientation. I've had a lot of pushback in my book about the fact that orientation is not chosen. And so I look at the person and I say, are you heterosexual? Well, yes, I am. Well, when did you pray through about that? What morning did you wake up and decide that you were going to be that? So we need to be very careful that we do not judge orientation as a moral choice. We need to know that it is a human's behavioral choice that is moral. Now, having said that, I recognize that we talk about sin on two levels. We talk about sin as individual behavior, but we also talk about sin in a more corporate way, the sin of a broken world and what has happened to our world because of sin. And there is a sense in which you could put homosexual orientation in the category of a world gone wrong, a world that is broken, especially in these cases where a child has been abused or something has been done to a person. What was done to them was sinful. Sin caused this. It does not make that person immoral because of what was done to them, but we do have to recognize that sin in a corporate nature is involved in that in some ways. That is a, I think this is a very important beginning point to get clear if we're going to deal with the complexity of this particular issue. Okay, now, once you kind of get orientation settled, you move to the second question. And the second question would be this: why is homosexual behavior wrong? What is it that is wrong or sinful about this? This is where we go right back to what we talked about the last hour. That in, if we believe that the intimacy that we long for can only be had through sexual intercourse, and a person is homosexually oriented, and so they go to other people and multiple partners for this, they are seeking the intimacy that their soul desires through sexual relationships, which then teaches them to objectify other people, and it robs them of the capacity to love as God intended for them to love. I tell people, we do not discriminate in the church against homosexuals, because we call the heterosexual single adult and the homosexual single adult to the very same standard. We call them both to abstinence. We call them both to abstinence. So there is a sense in which this calling is very important for us to see. Then you have to begin to look at the definition. I think this is where sociology enters the picture. The male homosexuality and female homosexuality tend to be experienced in very different ways. For men, most men, there are multiple partners across a lifestyle, across a life. I've pastored men who've told me they've had as many as 100 and 200 sexual partners during their life. For females, what usually happens, they might have 3 or 4 relationships across their life, but more often than not, they tend to bind themselves to one person and stay with that person through their life. Now, given the choice between the two, this is the better, this would be the better of the two, rather than multiple partners, a partner. Which then, people began to press me then, okay, then what's wrong with two people who are homosexually oriented being married to one another and being faithful to one another for their entire life? And my response is this: given all the options on the other side that are worse than that, that's probably the best choice within homosexual behavior that one could make. And you would actually say we would certainly prefer that over a lifestyle of multiple sexual partners all the time. But we believe there is one step across the line that is even better than that. And that is to choose to live your life as a celibate single in the context of a church where you would experience intimacy and fellowship and belonging and membership. And that church would be to you your brothers and your sisters and your fathers and your mothers. And you would find within the context of that church the kind of rich fellowship and intimacy that would sustain you in a life of singleness. That we believe that would be a higher calling than even to be bound to one person. So we're not offering no option. We're saying we believe this would be the better choice of that. We also have the sense that that there is in creation itself a fittedness that God has made within creation. The body of a woman and the body of a man just fit together in ways that the body of a man and the body of a man, or the body of a woman and a body of a woman, do not fit together. Now, you know, I won't become graphic in all of the ways that, you know, they figured out, well, we can figure out how to fit. But there is a sense in which when God created Adam and Eve, they left father and mother. They cleaved to one another and the two became one. That fittedness is even deeper than physical. It is mental, it is emotional, it is psychological. There is something that happens within that that enables a bonding for life in every way. In the practices of homosexual intercourse, the number of those that actually move toward lifelong covenant faithfulness are very, very few. So what is being pushed at the church is that handful of examples of those who are, it's just two people and they're faithful to one. That's what's being pushed at us and said, why can't you accept this? When really about 95% of what is going on within that world is multiple sexual partners, broken people, people being objectified and used in every way. And they're asking us to somehow give up our opposition to this because there may be a few cases out here where people are being loving and faithful to one another in that context. The logic that condones any homosexual behavior is selfish. It's logic that claims that these desires are natural, that they are a need, and therefore the person has a right to this, to express themselves as they want. Again, it is the essence of sin. I want what I want regardless of you, regardless of what it might do to society, regardless of what it does to me or to my family. We all have these kind of selfish desires in us, but it does not mean we give ourselves to those desires. To the contrary, Christians are ultimately called to discipline our lives, to lay down our lives for others, and to bear the fruit of the Spirit, which is self-control. Now, let me move to the third statement. I've heard this one a few times. The person says, I am a practicing homosexual Christian. Have you heard that? Have you run into that person? We've got them all over the states. Matter of fact, we have a whole group of denominations called the Metropolitan Church, which is the gathering of those who are practicing homosexuals, and they gather for worship on Sundays. And it is a growing church, large churches like that. Well, here's how I want to respond to that. Okay, there's two different terms here: practicing homosexual and Christian. Which one comes first? I mean, just tell me, which one of these identifiers of you is Lord of your life? Which one do you bow to over the other? Man cannot serve God and mammon. He will hate the one and choose the other. We do not have multiple lords over our life. We're either deceived that we are self-sovereign and we are the Lord of our own life, or we lay that down and we are crucified with Christ and He is our Lord. So I want to say to those, does your practicing homosexuality, does that define what you mean by Christian? Or does Christian inform your sexual ethic? Which way do you want? You cannot have it both ways. Which one are you? Which one is your Lord in this way? And to drive people to say that is critically important, because the idea of serving multiple gods is blasphemy in many ways. So what I find is that many practicing homosexuals who want full acceptance of their behavior in the context of the church are asking that that choice be Lord of their ethics over anything that the church or Scripture has to say about that. Number four. So what is the call of God for Christians who are homosexually oriented? I believe that it is that those who are oriented and are Christian are called to a life of abstinence, a life of celibacy. But, I'll get to this in a minute. No one chooses to be this. In the same way, children are born with a genetic predisposition to alcoholism. That happens. Now, we don't take that child born with a predisposition to alcoholism such that one drink and suddenly they are an alcoholic. I mean, they are into something that they do not have the physiological capacity to get out of. We don't take that person and put them in an immoral category and say, this child is evil. this child, you know, shun this person, don't have anything. We don't do that. What we say to that person is, you cannot afford with the orientation that you have to go down this road. If you go down this road, it will destroy you. You will destroy yourself in the process of this particular way of living and this lifestyle and this way of relating to other people. So we must be careful to help that person to know how to live out the orientation that they have as they go forward. Which leads me to the fifth question. Can a person who is homosexually oriented be reoriented to heterosexuality? My experience has been maybe 10 to 20% at best. I don't see massive reorientation of one's sexual orientation happening. Where I have seen it happen, though, is in the teenage and college years. Because in those years, many whose orientation has been shaped by child abuse or sexual abuse or early orientation, if they can be carefully guided to understand what was done to them, how it affects them, or if they grew up in a particular kind of home with a particular model of a father, a particular model of a mother, if this is the root cause of it, sometimes good biblical counseling, good psychological counseling can help this person understand things about themselves, and there is a reorientation that can be had there. But if a person, this is my opinion, it's observation, I don't have any fact for this, but if a person is able to get all the way through college, the chance of reorientation beyond college with that, they've lived with it too long, it is somehow hardened within them, and the orientation rarely reverts at that point. Which is why, I'll put my Trevecca hat on. This is why our Christian colleges are so important. Because this student goes to a secular university and all they're told is, hey, that's the way you were born. This is how you live. You have every right to be this way. There is no one who sits and listens to their story and listens to their pain, wants to know what happened to them, cares about their family. There's no one who is entering that conversation that even offers them any hope that there may be a reorientation by understanding themselves. And it's critical that we have our Christian schools and our Christian colleges so that in those moments, these young people are in the kind of caring community that will talk with them about these things and help them in that way and guide them as they would move forward. The six, I think this is the last one I'm going to deal with here. There is a seventh question, and I just don't have time to do it, but you're going to get the book. And the seventh question is, what does the Bible have to say about the practice of homosexuality? And that's about a 5 or 6 page. It is a long text-by-text exegesis of all of those. You're going to get that in an e-book electronic format when I send it to Klaus and he sends it to you. And you can go in and do the exegetical work there. So I believe the Bible is very pointed in terms of this is not behavior accepting to Christians. But the last one I'll do, how do we show God's grace to those who are homosexually oriented without condoning their lifestyle? Now, how do we show grace in this way? Well, there are two wrong responses right off the bat. And the first wrong response is to say, well, if you'll just go to the altar and pray, God will change you. We make a promise that experience says cannot be kept. Remember, we are Wesleyans. Remember tradition and scripture and reason and experience. We have known from the experiences that people have that sexual orientation is not something you go to an altar, you tell God, and God changes you like that. Sexual orientation is deeply woven into us biologically, experientially, physically, however. So I think we place an undue burden on these people to hold out that kind of naive hope that is out there. The second wrong response is to believe that homosexual orientation is irreversible and therefore we just accept it and go on. Because many times if a person finds the courage to talk with a believer about this, what they're saying is, I don't know for sure. I'm confused. I may be, I may not be. I don't know. And for the church not to at least engage the conversation, there are those that we could help toward heterosexual orientation. But if we don't believe that that might not, that that's not even possible, then we won't even engage that. So we don't make promises of a quick, easy fix, nor do we just assume that nothing can be done about this. We have to find our way between those two. I think now this will be the most important thing I'll say about this, and I want to read it because I want to be very careful in this language. Our greatest failure as a church is to imagine that a homosexually oriented person could live a celibate life without the benefit of Christian community. We are created for human intimacy. We need human touch, conversation, inclusion, belonging, and care. Counseling a person in the office or at the altar is not the end of this person's struggle. It is a battle waged in the trenches of this person's daily life. The homosexual has real needs. He or she is asking, who do I talk to, eat with, play with, share holidays with, celebrate birthdays with? Who hugs me? Who listens to me when I am sad? Who calls me on the phone? Who thinks to include me in the Sunday lunch dinner? Where do I live? Who do I live with? They're asking all of these questions. If the church wants to get serious about helping the homosexually oriented person live a celibate Christian life, we must think in terms of rich, gracious hospitality. Christian singles will purchase large houses that become havens of belonging for women and men to live in God-honoring community together. Families will permanently open their homes to a new member of the family. Churches will develop support groups and provide mature mentors. The celibate, single, homosexual will be invited to full participation in the life and ministry of the church. We cannot expect this person to go off and cope with this and then come back to us when they have it settled. Our best means of grace is the fellowship of the church, and we must offer it to all. If the homosexual community out there, the practicing homosexual community, offers a better welcome in their bars than the people of God, that struggling person will go to that community for their sense of belonging instead of to the church. You may have some questions you want to ask about that, but I think our greatest failure is that we have not imagined with the person who is homosexually oriented, we have not imagined the kind of life that they would desire, which would be rich in belonging and meaning and inclusion in the church and having brothers and sisters and fellowship. We've not helped them see what that kind of life might look like. And for lack of that, there is a homosexual, practicing homosexual community out in the world that says, hey, come on over here. We'll love you. We'll take you in. We'll hug you. We'll celebrate your birthday. We'll do all this stuff. And the church is over here saying, oh, get your act straight and then maybe we'll accept you. We have to do better than that if we expect to be able to help these people. I'll close with this. The church is going to have to step into that kind of love. We're going to have to step into that kind of love. And the world is not going to agree with us about our conclusions about sexual behavior. They're just not. The world's on a different story. We talked about it in the earlier hour. But we can offer an option, and we can offer an option that looks like Jesus in every way. And I think it is our calling to do that. Maybe, I don't know, maybe the homosexually oriented person is the tax collector of the New Testament days. Maybe that person is the woman caught in adultery. Maybe that person is the one whose birth defect caused them to be unclean down at the temple. I don't know. But I do know that Jesus dealt with people that were outcast. And some of the reasons some of them were outcasts, like the tax collectors, were because they did immoral things and people hated them for that. And yet there was room at the table of Jesus for these. And he goes and he calls Matthew to be one of his disciples. A tax collector, friend of sinners. No wonder Jesus was called that. May our lives be so Christ-like that we too would be accused of being a friend of sinners in a world like this. You do not have to stop believing morally what you believe to love someone. And you do not have to coerce them to act like you to love them. Love is freely given in hopes that the Spirit of God will work in that love to redeem this person into the family of God. I need to stop. We have 20 minutes, and I'm sure you might have some questions about this. So no questions? Well, let's go eat lunch. For the sake of people who may listen to this session, we want them to hear your questions. So we have some microphones here. So if you have a question, who's going to take the microphone? We just need a person that'll take a microphone. Well, just come to the microphone. That's probably the easiest way. There are two here and two here. So if you don't mind, just come to the microphone so that we can hear the question and make sure the people who listen will know what I'm responding to. Your turn.
Question, just out of our own experience, our son went to America at 19 and got rather devastated by life at that point. And some friends of ours kept him, but then said, well, now you have to leave, and they put him out on the street. And of course, we were thousands of miles away. And a homosexual community of men let him sleep on a mattress in their basement.
Yeah.
Which, of course, gave us sort of a heart attack at first, but they did not touch him and try to persuade him to be one of them. They simply gave him a loving place to be. And I remember calling Keith at a later point in time and thanking him for taking in our son and letting him have a place to be. And so my experience in hearing people's contacts with homosexuals is that they are often very loving.
Yes.
And so somehow I think we've got to find a bridge to help ourselves understand that they're not, at least not the militant ones marching on the streets, but there's a whole set of people that are simply loving and have just deep struggles. So I just thought I'd throw that in as a
comment. They are so hungry for human intimacy that they know other humans deserve this. They really are. I think it may be why Jesus said at one point to the religious leaders that the tax collectors and prostitutes will enter the kingdom ahead of you. They get some things that you don't get, and that's a perfect picture of that. Perfect picture of that. Thank you.
The question I have is about how do you change church culture when people are militant in their opinions?
I've got some experience on that one. The congregation I served at Olivet was a very old line. Very traditional, very conservative congregation. And when I preached a sermon about homosexuality, and I mentioned last night, a person came to me and says, you don't need to do that. We have none of them around here. If we do, they'll be gone soon. There was some significant opposition about even addressing that. But the altar call that I gave at the end of that sermon was simply this. I'm going to ask a question, and I'm going to ask all who would like to respond to stand. And I said that to the congregation. I said, if a person is struggling with their sexual orientation and is looking for a friend who would not condone any behavior, but who would lovingly listen to them would pray for them, would walk with them, would be their friend, and you would be willing to be that person, would you stand? Maybe 40% of the congregation stood. In other words, here I am pastoring a congregation which 60% of the people said, I can't do that. I would not welcome into my life a person of a different sexual orientation. That single service, though, started something in that congregation that was redemptive and that was good. And across the next 2 years, person after person after person came to me and said, do you remember that service? I didn't stand, but I would stand today. Because I've watched how others who did stand have lived that life and the difference that they're making in the world. Out of that sermon, there was a couple in their 30s who were doing very well in their business. They purchased a huge home. It had like 15 bedrooms in it. I mean, it was a big old home. And they said to me, we've purchased this home so that people who are homosexually oriented and seeking to live in a covenant community of celibacy and abstinence, that they would have a place to live, men and women. And they had this huge table every night, and they all cooked meals together. They watched movies together. They popped popcorn. They played volleyball out in the backyard. They had their own church softball team. They shared life together. And I thought it was one of the most gracious responses of the church and of grace to that. And they talked openly about who they were and their struggles, but they found the kind of fellowship and family and belonging and intimacy that human beings needed. And their model, I never publicly held them up or said, look what they're doing. But the people in the church began to watch that and see that, and they began to see how these people were involved in the life of the congregation and how they were living holy lives of service to others. And they saw the hospitality of that particular home. That began to change the culture of that church. You won't do it overnight, but I think if you continue to hold up the model of Jesus, loving the outsider, the outcast, the morally stigmatized, if you keep holding that up, over time, you'll see the Spirit of God begin to move people in that direction. Now, there are some folk who prefer not to be bothered with the issue. Their mind is made up and you'll never move them. I just place them in the gracious hands of God and leave them there and say, God, you'll have to deal with this. There's nothing I can do. And so I don't spend a whole lot of time trying to move a rock that's bigger than I am. I just say, God, you know them and this is where they are. But I also refuse to let those people form the agenda of the mission of God for our church. So I say, you may not agree with me on this, and we're still brothers. I understand where you are. I'm not going to ask you, I'm not going to try to make you move from where you are. I'll leave that to the Spirit of God working in you. But as a people of God, when we sit and read the Scriptures, it seems to say to us, we ought to be doing this, and we're going to go do this. And you can oppose. It's okay. You can sit among us, and, I will never shame you. I'll never judge you or call you out. I leave you in the hands of God, which scares them to death, to be honest with you. But I just tell them, this is where I place you. If you're okay with this before God, thank you. Yes. Whoever gets there first.
Sorry. I do appreciate your borderline approach. You're kind of out there. That is good.
It's scary.
Which is great. I love it. But and you mentioned several causes for homosexuality, maybe bad home or whatever. What I still miss a little bit is, or what I was wondering about, is my wife is a psychologist, and we have several psychologists in our church. Mm-hmm. They're all Christians. Mm-hmm. And they have several homosexuals coming in there in their talks, and they talk to them. And sometimes they figure out, okay, there's a trauma in their childhood or whatever, and then they talk about it.
Yeah.
they deal with it, and suddenly that person is not a homosexual anymore.
Yes.
And what I see is we all talk a little bit about still as something being
born in a
wrong, yeah. Or that there is an error.
Yeah.
There's something.
Yeah.
Wrong.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure, because at some point these psychologists, most of them tell me when they have homosexuals coming in and they do research, is their trauma and their history and their past.
Yeah.
And sometimes they have to conclude, you know what, this is authentic.
Yeah.
So I wonder if we are still, you know, we're just finding another approach,
yeah.
Or if we're still judging the authenticity of their love.
See, I believe because there are multiple issues that might lead to orientation, that we need to try to get to the bottom of that with that person. And I think Christian counseling is the best way to do it, because there are those whose orientation might be reoriented. They discover that about themselves. And I think that is a gracious, truthful act of God. I commend those psychologists in your church. We have a PhD in clinical psychology there at Trevecca.
Yeah.
And this is the approach that we take there, that we hear the story of this person. We try to hear if there's trauma or tragedy or family influence of some sort. So, I totally agree with what you said.
Well, my only concern is that we judge love, you know, whereas mm-hmm. you say it's our... It's ours to give love,
yeah.
Not to judge love.
Yeah.
I changed churches a couple of months ago, and now I'm in a church that's quite different. So, but still Nazarene, apparently. A couple of weeks back, you know, I was serving communion and serving the elements, and there I am with the bread, and there are these two guys holding hands in front of me, and I was thinking, okay. Who am I to judge their love?
Yeah.
Here you go. Last Sunday, I performed a pastoral prayer for a guy who requested that I pray for his partner who is undergoing surgery.
Mm-hmm.
And they're together for 40 years.
Yeah.
It's like, who am I to judge their love?
Yeah.
Let me pray for them.
Yeah.
Just a thought
that
I'm not here to judge love and then try to be nice by pretending giving love.
Yeah. Yeah. Those are the rare cases that I think the church is going to just have to find an elastic band and figure out how far can we stretch and how far do we go with that. So, but very good. Yes, Benjamin.
Amen. First, I want to thank you so much for the great insight you've given me on this subject. But I have two questions that I think is a personal question to you. I would like to know the answer you give to Haiti. Is that Haiti, yeah? When she came to you.
Yeah.
Yeah, when she came to you for the first time and said this was her orientation. And then secondly, this is a very sincere and genuine question. My brother just said, if you had accepted, or I don't know if you accepted it and gone to the wedding, was it not an act of condoning? You know, I'm just asking, just like he also said.
Yeah, for the first... What we did when she told us that is we said to her, we have already known this. This is not a surprise to us. And then we said, we believe that what caused this has been the family that you grew up in, because we know the story of that. And we want to pay for you to have professional counseling. And she went through about two years of counseling. Matter of fact, she now has her own PhD in psychology, has gone all the way through to finish a PhD in psychology. But everything that we did in seeking to help her understand that, with the potential of reorientation, it did not take for her. She still continued to consider herself homosexually oriented. So we didn't just say, well, that's what you are, we still accept you. We said, let us try to help you with this. The condoning issue of going to the wedding... Sometimes these are very difficult calls, but for me, for a Christian to choose to be absent of a meaningful celebration in a person's life and to let that be the way they protest their behavior, I think that creates more blockages and obstacles in it. our present, now remember they broke up, so we never even went to the wedding, so I never had that experience. But I felt like if she is there and she believes this is one of the most important days of her life, and the people who are her family have said, we will not even be present for this, that would have placed an obstacle in our ability to love her that would not have been positive for us. The truth is, I actually believe today, had Denise and I not been in her life, she would not be alive today. And so for us to be with her and to be present there is somewhat of a sign of grace. I think it's why Jesus was willing to show up at the dinner parties of all the sinners and tax collectors, and you know, he eats with publicans and sinners. And I think he demonstrated a security in his own holiness that allowed him to be in the middle of evil and shine like a light there. And that's what we seek to do. Every time that we're in a setting like that, where we are suddenly in the minority, and we are odd, and we're the only heterosexual straight couple in the room, when we're in those kind of settings, I say, God, help us to shine. Help us to look like Jesus. Let our words and our deeds and our conversation in this room, let it bring honor and glory to you. I think God wants to put us in those kind of settings. Yes, there would have been people in my church who would have said, oh, you're condoning it. You know, by going, you say this is okay. For us, we felt like it was the right thing to do, to be present. But those are hard decisions. There could be cases where I would probably say, no, I'll not come. I'll not come, so... 4 minutes. Who has a 4-minute question? I'll ask a quick one. Should the Church of the Nazarene ordain homosexually oriented people who are living celibate lifestyles? We already do. There are many out there who are serving the church as a single adult, living a celibate life. They've never been public about that. They've never told anyone. But we have never said to that person who lived a pure and holy lifestyle, you cannot serve in the Church of Jesus. Now, if they cross that line in behavior, we would act the same way we would if a heterosexual single crossed that line, or a married person crossed that line into adultery. We would discipline in the very same way and say, this is not a model for the body of Christ. That will be one of the big fights that the church will have one day soon. It'll come our way. We have several things to fight through that others are already fighting about, and we'll see how that goes.
Yes. I have one more question.
Can you use the microphone so we can catch that there?
In Holland as well as in Germany, there's a lot of discussion, can gay couples or lesbian couples adopt kids? The argument is it's better to have no family and to live in an orphanage than to live with a loving family. Mm-hmm. What would you say to that?
I think it's too early to answer the question in terms of sociological and psychological studies of the impact of those families on children, because it's just now beginning, and you really need about a 20-year run before you're able to say this is the effect of on a child who grows up in a same-sex home. So there's a lot that we don't know about that yet, and I'm more than willing to confess that Heidi and her partner Laura, They were very loving parents to their daughter, but that little girl is still a very, very young girl. I have no clue what influence or impact that might have. The church isn't often asked to determine what the law is going to be about that. So there's a sense in which the world will choose to legitimate what it chooses, and then we are left with reacting to that. I think the church still says that the most healthy environment for a child to grow up in is a child where there is a male and female role model that is there and the love between them is strong. And we continue to do that. But there are children abandoned and abused that would be loved by someone who is homosexually oriented or a faithful married homosexual couple that that child may well have a better life there than to put them in situations where they're continuing to be abused. So, you know, the grace of God can often come to one through means that we would have never chosen. I mean, it's a complex issue. My preference would be no, this is not the definition of a family. But there are situations in which love is offered, and I can protest legally the larger issue, but then I have to go individual issue to individual issue and say, is this a better thing for this child than that? And so those cases I have to look at one at a time and say, what is the most loving and best thing that is possible for this child? Sometimes the world offers us Christians 4 bad alternatives to choose from. And we're left with choosing the best of 4 bad ideas. And I think this sometimes is that situation. So.